I have a second reading, this one from theologian Rebecca Parker. Before I read it, I offer a clarification that when she or I speak about liberals or progressives, we mean religiously rather than politically liberal. Now, it's common for the two to align, but they don't automatically. So it's important to be clear that liberal in this reading and in my sermon is a religious description. With that said, the perils of religious community have left many liberals and progressives convinced that organized religious communities cannot be trusted. They pose too many dangers and break too many promises. They fail to embody what they profess and disappoint those who invest their lives in them. Such wariness about religious community puts liberals and progressives in sacred company. The Hebrew prophets condemned religion when its priests soothed the privileged but neglected the poor. In the book of Amos, the prophet declares, "Take away the noise of your singing. Stop your ritual sacrifices. Instead, let justice roll down like waters." When he made these bitter declarations, Amos was speaking to his own people, the Israelites. It was a time of prosperity and wealth, at least for the ruling class, not so much for everyone else. Amos, like his fellow prophets Isaiah and Micah, was appalled at the ways that the Israelites were interpreting their religion. He says, "I hate, despise your festivals and your sacrifices and burnt offerings." None of the prophets could stand the empty rituals, the hypocritical prayers declaring peace, peace, when there was no peace. From the Hebrew prophets' interpretation, a righteous life meant taking care of the poor, the marginalized, the stranger, not just performing a bunch of rituals and acting holy. And if you read the details of the 613 rules given to Moses, not even just 10, but actually 613, it's pretty clear the prophets were right. But then, as now, people were busy and don't always remember so many things at once. 613 was a lot. And life gets distracting. And so another of the prophets, Micah, spoke more clearly and succinctly. "What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?" In these three simple and beautiful phrases, Micah managed to offer a vision that remains even today a specific and yet broad enough that people of a wide variety of theological orientations and faith traditions use it as both a map and compass, an orientation for life, despite the passing of some nearly 3,000 years. As an illustration of its appeal, my friend, a Unitarian Universalist minister about my age, has the phrase tattooed on her arm. She talks about it as her personal mission statement. And as you may have noticed, David's most common benediction uses the phrase, although somewhat reworded, inviting us to do justice, love kindness, and to walk humbly with all that is to you holy. Now, on the other end of the theological spectrum, the chapter and verse of this phrase in Micah are the source for the name of the service arm of the Timberline Church, Service 6-8. Serve 6-8. Right? Have you heard of it? Serve 6-8. Chapter 6 in Micah, verse 8. Through Serve 6-8, Timberline provides financial assistance, food boxes, home repair, food preparation, and a variety of other supports, including having recently taken over the Sister Mary Alice Murphy Center, a resource center for the homeless. Through all of these services and many others, Serve 6-8 does, as they describe on their website, serve our community, demonstrating God's love in tangible ways with no strings attached. I find their work and mission. Just so beautiful and inspiring. And I am not a small bit jealous. See, I want to be a part of a faith tradition that makes such a big impact on my community, that connects my faith with this impact, and that creates a clear and tangible way for me and my church community to care for those in our wider community. And I want to be able to trust that underlying this good invitation is a foundation aligned with my values and theological claims, which is to say a foundation that seeks to dismantle rather than reinforce patriarchy and white supremacy, undo rather than teach heterosexism and homophobia, interrogate rather than affirm colonialism and American exceptionalism, transform rather than overlook classism and ableism, and most of all, one that sees our lot as fundamentally bound up together, which is to say that none are saved until all are saved, which means that we don't just enact charity, we address the systems that keep people marginalized and othered, and that we seek a transformation of ourselves and a transformation of the whole. Where are the serve 6-8s that are built on this kind of justice? Unfortunately, as far as I know, they don't exist. Nothing like Serve 6-8, with its degree of reach and local impact, with its force of volunteers and its level of funding, it's big, exists within a liberal, progressive theological paradigm, Unitarian Universalist or otherwise. Now, sure, we have the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, but that is internationally focused and invites individuals to participate in a broad call, rather than a community that's inspired by the specific heartbreak and call of their own particular context, by their own covenanted community. And I wonder why. We are all about justice, so I wonder why. Don't you? I have a couple of theories. Now, one, I think a lot of our people, I do think a lot of our people do this work professionally. I think they found and run and work at nonprofits, which means they just don't feel the need or have the time or the energy to do locally based justice work as a part of their faith community, which also means they don't feel the need or understand how they could tie their work to their faith commitments, their spiritual path, or their theological claims. But I also think it's more than that. After Rebecca Parker acknowledges that our discomfort with religious institutions aligns us with the Hebrew prophets, she goes on to describe how, as a result, liberal and progressive people of faith are more at home alone than in the company of others. This is what Fred Muir, by the way, has described as the I-church phenomenon, a church that prizes individualism above all. Parker goes on, many liberals, consciously or not, seem to prefer that their religious institutions remain weak, underfunded, or distracted by endless attention to process and checks on the exercise of power. Too much money, power, or organization, it is feared, will lead to corruption. One friend of mine, she says, a United Methodist lay leader and community activist, quips that liberal religion teaches you that you can do anything you feel called to do as long as you do it alone. This is lonely, frustrating, and inevitably heartbreaking path that we have sentenced ourselves to. It reminds me of a moment in seminary when my professor, a Native American activist and scholar, he asked us, a group of liberal seminarians, if we believed power was a bad word. There was a general sense of well, obviously. He said, no, it's not power that's good or bad. Power is neither good nor bad in and of itself. It's how power is used that can be good or bad, moral or immoral, just or unjust. Despite the historical trend, I'm convinced that it doesn't have to be this way. I am convinced that we can transform our understanding of what is required of us, detach it from that grip of individualism and idealizing of a bunch of individual paths and commitments of those who happen to all hang out together once in a while, and the fear of that powerful, which is to say a power used for a vision that could be good, we could release ourselves from that fear of power in a religious institution. And the key to such a transformation, what you might call our salvation, I believe lies in the beloved community. Now, when I first heard the term, I was a relatively new Unitarian Universalist attending a church where there was pervasive bickering and backstabbing behind the scenes. And so when the minister called our church beloved community from the pulpit, I nearly let out a ha! I didn't. I didn't know anything about the concept, the tradition that he was pointing to. I only knew the words beloved community felt like a mismatch to what I was experiencing, and thus just more support for my own history of religious institutions not living up to their promises. It wasn't until a few years later when I was attending an annual conference put on by our district where I realized that beloved community wasn't just a fancy way to say the community I love. It turns out the term dates back to the late 19th century with philosopher Josiah Royce, who described it as the highest ideal of human community, achieving the highest good for the most common good. Then, kind of stayed in the academic corners for a while. But then in the mid-20th century, a Baptist preacher named Martin Luther King Jr., after hearing about it in seminary, started preaching beloved community as our ultimate ends. The ultimate end for churches, for activists, and for any human beings who cared about justice and about the question of what the Lord, or you might say love, requires. As the King Center website describes it, beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. There's no poverty or hunger or homelessness, no racism or bigotry. Instead, there is an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. Love and trust triumph over fear and hatred. All conflict can be resolved peacefully and ends with a reconciliation of adversaries cooperating together in a spirit of friendship and goodwill. In short, beloved community is a humanistic, this-worldly vision of the kingdom, or what we might call the kingdom of God. Now, since King, progressives of all kinds have taken up the concept of beloved community and continued to enrich and deepen its meaning, recognizing it as an idealized expression of our own covenantal tradition. As an example, in his book, The Prophetic Imperative, Unitarian minister Richard Gilbert describes the beloved community as, quote, an image embodying human hopes and standing over against human finitude in judgment of the social order. Its basic characteristic is human solidarity. He goes on to assert that the beloved community is, quote, the highest common denominator for Unitarian Universalists, and thus an appropriate symbol for us. Beloved community can be, for the local liberal church, that's us, that shared understanding of what it means to do justice, not just as a bunch of individuals on our own paths, but on a shared path together. It is who we are. At our core, we are beloved community. Which brings me to what I want to call my five guideposts, guidelines. I thought about a five-fold path, but that seemed a little, presumptuous. I want to say guidelines. for discerning what is required of us. And it's based in my understanding of beloved community. It's two more answers than Micah gave, but still fewer than the 613 in the covenant code. So hopefully still simple enough for us in our congregation to use as a kind of tool and reminder as we discern our way forward. The first, like my minister said a number of years back, we are the beloved community. Despite my skepticism when I first heard it, and maybe yours today, beloved community does begin with us, this congregation, you and me. It begins with the ways we treat each other and treat our staff, the community around us. It's in the ways we show up as friends and neighbors, family members, the ways we transform ourselves and transform the world. A church is a microcosm of the values that it espouses, or at least it's supposed to be. When it isn't, well, that's when we end up with all our cynicism and skepticism about religion in the first place. But luckily, as James Luther Adams would say, we go to church to practice being human. And so in our practice, we help each other be better humans. We help each other be the beloved community. Small groups and regular worship, shared service both within and beyond the congregation, our recent practice of the covenant of right relations, all of these are our practice at being the beloved community. Number two, actually we're not, and nor is the world, beloved community. Our culture teaches us to accept things that are actually unacceptable all the time. And so part of the work of the church is about seeing life with new eyes. I mean, to live in this world, somehow we must learn to accept the fact that a two-year-old can shoot her mother in Walmart with a legal gun. We find ways to accept the fact that we just walk right past that homeless teenager on the mall. We learn to find it normal that some people have multiple multi-million dollar homes and other people have no home at all. We get used to the degrading comments about women or gays or people of color that we hear in our workplace or our families. I mean, these things are not okay. Right? As Martin Luther King said, there are some things where it is right to be maladjusted. And we need our church to be a place that can remind us that these things are not okay. We need it to be a place where we can confess our heartbreak and our confusion and our vulnerability. We need to be able to let down our walls and our coping mechanisms and begin to remember life like it's supposed to be. And then gain the tools to create that world. A cycle of action and reflection is really helpful for this kind of unseeing and re-seeing, rebuilding. Theory, after all, we've tried, it can't save us. Talking can't save us. If it could, we truly would be the beloved community. But action without grounded reflection can't save us either. We need both. For only when we understand the heartbreak of the world and then we link it to the aching of our own hearts and our real lives, can we understand how and where we need to act and why. Number three, this means we need spiritual practice and we need a constructed theology. Sustained open-heartedness, keeping your heart open, looking at the world as it actually is, requires feeling connected to something greater than ourselves, a greater love, the interdependent web, the spirit of life, God. And sustained waking up requires meaning-making around that something greater. We need constructive, positive theology, not just the stuff we don't believe. We need to know the words we'd want said at our bedside and the bedside of those we love. We need to have a sense of how and why we keep going in the face of loss and disappointment. And then we need to be able to tell each other all this stuff because we're going to need reminders a lot. Number four. We're lucky on this because Beloved, community is all about relationship. From a position of companioning, we are invited alongside one another, unlearning those dehumanizing patterns of racism, classism, sexism, dehumanizing patterns for us all, and establishing new patterns and habits of partnership, hearing each other's stories rather than responding to issues. Hearing each other's stories instead of responding just to issues. Working together rather than taking sides. Responding to the felt needs rather than to headlines. Resisting what my colleague, the Reverend Deborah Holder, calls the, quote, marbles under our feet of the next big crisis. Which reminds me, unsubscribe from the email lists. Just do. There's no relationship there. Beloved, community does not compete for resources, but collaborates towards more for everyone. Simply put, in the beloved community paradigm, we don't do stuff that others are already doing well. We strengthen our ties, help each other out, and offer the unique gifts that we have, and rejoice in our working together. Which brings me to my last one, number 5. We have to get clear on what it is that only we can do, and do that. This one builds on all the other 4, all of which teach us where we are needed and called. This is, from what I understand, the kind of work that had led us to our partnership with Faith Family Hospitality and to the creation of our ESL tutoring program. Getting to our answer for the future is what our appreciative inquiry process will be about in the next couple months, which is why we are asking everyone, to sign up for 1 of the 6 sessions. Just pick one. You can sign up in the social hall today. It's that important. We need everyone involved. Now, my own bias about our specific call is geared to the local, super local, our own neighborhood even. As an example, following a tradition that Mark had started many years ago and encouraged by our caring team, I went and visited a bunch of our neighbors, before Christmas to say thank you for being a good neighbor, for putting up with the cars, and to introduce myself. It was very moving, and what I understood later to be a really important work. More than one greeted me with tears in their eyes. And most were happy to be invited to a church with what they called a lady minister. I thought of one of my teachers, Kay Northcutt, who has a debilitating disease that keeps her mostly homebound, and who tells of being regularly visited by Jehovah's Witnesses. But, she told a gathering of UUs a couple years ago, she was never once visited by a Unitarian. Why? She wondered. Did we not believe we should bring our love out into the world? Bring our love to the homebound, the lonely, the yearning hearts of all kinds, a world hungry for connection and kindness, a vision of beloved community. If we are to live up to all that is required of us, these 5 guidelines, being the beloved community, educating ourselves about all the ways we and the world are not beloved community, committing to spiritual practice and theological construction, and putting relationships at the center of our work, and getting clear on what it is that we and only we can do, and following through. These 5 are my sense and hope for how we will fulfill the promise that we make to ourselves each week when we say love is the spirit of this church. Because what we mean to say is agape love is the spirit of this church. In this path, I believe we can get over our fear of the powerful liberal religious institution and instead become its champion. We can release our good news into the world knowing it is worthy of our very best resources, our money, our time, our testimony, even our door-to-door. It's possible because it is a vision of the world that we believe in. It is our shared vision of beloved community. May it be so.
moment.